Welcome back, everyone, for our second session. It's going to be very exciting. Are we all in here? Most importantly, is our speaker in here? So without further ado, let's bring up Bill Cloud, and he can finish taking us down this trail of the mixed kingdom.
All righty. Everybody got to stretch their legs a little bit, do other things. So this is the hardcore group here then, right? All right, so here is my understanding is I have until 1:30. At least. No, I'm just kidding. I want to go back over to Revelation chapter 17. And in verse 6, after John sees this, he says, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Yeshua. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. But the angel said to me, why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast that you saw was and is not will ascend out of the bottomless pit, go to perdition, and those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. They are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth and is of the seven and is going to perdition. All right, we won't have time to get into all that today because that would take a whole afternoon just to discuss all of that. We're not going to focus on the beast today. We're focusing on the woman. But then it says this in verse 12. It says, the ten horns which you saw, the ten horns that are growing on the beast, are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as the kings with the beast, as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, thinking the same way. And they will give their power and authority to the beast. They will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is the Lord of hosts and King of kings. And those who are with him are called chosen and faithful. And then he goes on to talk about the woman, where she sits. It represents peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. And so it transcends borders. My point here is that Babylon is not just an archaeological site in Iraq. Babylon is not just a place. More importantly, Babylon, as far as we're concerned, is a way of thinking. It is a philosophy. It is an ideology. And it is one that transcends borders. It's borderless. That's why they don't want borders, because it's supposed to transcend borders. And then it says, the ten horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot, make her desolate, and naked, eat her flesh and burn her with fire. We talked about that. This is ironically what happens or is supposed to happen to the daughter of a priest who plays the harlot. But then it says this, and this is what is so fascinating to me. Here's why that happens. For God has put it into their hearts to fulfill his purpose. His purpose. To be of one mind and to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And then it talks about how the woman you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Now, what great city is referred to in Revelation chapter 18? Not Rome. Babylon. On and on, it talks about Babylon being this great city. And its greatness is not that it's the biggest city necessarily, or it's the best city. Its greatness, actually, it seems to me, is predicated on the fact that it has this way of influencing the entire world. That's what makes it great. But its influence is not good. It leads to death. All right, so the woman is going to be destroyed ultimately. and everything she represents. And the woman seems to be, maybe, anyway, somebody's wife, but who's been playing the harlot, who's gone out and committed fornication with all these other lovers and mixed the seed of her husband with that of all these other Belim, if I can say it that way. All these other husbands, these kings of the earth. And is riding the beast. And the beast is allowing her to ride until it comes time for her to be finished off. That would seem to suggest that her purpose, as far as the beast is concerned, is over. We've used her. Now we're going to get rid of her. I mean, that's kind of what some of these men do. They use women. They seduce them. They make them think they love them. They use them. They abuse them. And they get rid of them. So that's what happens. It's interesting to me that in the beginning, the woman is the one that the serpent, the Nachash, the shining one, who, by the way, is described in Genesis 3 not as a slithering, creeping thing, but who was the most subtle, that is, sly, crafty, clever, slick, beasts of the field. So in the beginning, the serpent, who John in Revelation chapter 12 calls the devil, that serpent of old, he is regarded as being a beast. And it is the beast who speaks to the woman to get her to turn her head away from the tree of life, to gaze upon the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, this mixed and mingled tree that renders death. He's the one who seduces her with his words, and she ends up ingesting his words, so to speak. You need to understand why that's important, because his word is likened unto a seed. A sower goes out to sow, and what is he sowing into the ground? He is sowing a seed. But what does that seed represent? The Messiah tells us the seed is the word. How do you distinguish between God's children and those of the adversary? John says in 1 John 3 that his seed is in us. That is the word of God personified in the Messiah. And to as many as received him, to them he gave the power, that is the right and the ability to become the sons of God. All right, well, guess what? It works, or the concept works the same way, except in reverse, with the other seed, the seed of the serpent. He speaks his words, and what are his words? Lies. He's the father of lies. He speaks of a lie. He speaks a lie. He does it out of his own resources, because he is the source of it. Well, every convincing lie will always contain a measure of truth. It will be good and evil. And so the woman in Genesis 3 in some way is consorting with the serpent, not having physical relations. Let me say that again. Not having physical relations, but receiving his words, being impregnated with his seed, to arrive at the conclusion that this tree, in spite of what the Creator said, is good for food. It is a tree that is pleasant to look upon. It is a tree desirable to make one wise. He seduced the woman to be impregnated with his words, and then what did she do? In her deception, perhaps unwittingly, she turns to her husband who is with her and seduces him into eating the fruit. And that's what led to their exile from the land. Not by one woman, but by one man sin entered into the world. But the woman played a significant role in it because she was first deceived and then seduces her husband to eat the same fruit. And who do you think the serpent was going after ultimately? The man. Because he was the head. In fact, in the genealogy of the Messiah, in the Gospel of Luke, he is called the Son of God. So he's going after the head. Let's put it this way. Who is it in this world today that the adversary wants to topple, wants to destroy? You and me. Because we're supposed to be the head and not the tail, right? We're in this body serving under the head, the Messiah, and we're supposed to be a body in the earth that is doing his will, serving his purposes. Well, that's a great threat to the adversary. And so what does he want to do? He wants to sow his words into those who will receive it, who will be seduced by it, who will be deceived by it. And then he uses them to topple the body, so to speak. That's his goal. I know I'm going to jump all around here for a moment, but you're just going to have to think fast, all right? The parable of the wheat and the tare. What is sown in the field, which is the world? The good seed. What is that good seed? It's the word of God. What does it produce? Wheat, who are called the sons of the kingdom. And so in the parable of the wheat and the tare, what we understand is the Creator from the beginning wanted to fill up the world not with just any people. He wanted to fill up the world with His people, those who had His word in them. How then does it have tares? An enemy has done this. When did the enemy do it? Under the cover of darkness, while men were sleeping. What should those men have been doing? They should have been sober. They should have been alert. They should have been on guard. They should have been protecting that which had been entrusted to them. The priest in the sanctuary, one of the jobs they had, besides making sure that there was oil in the menorah and the table of the shewbread had the fresh loaves and all the different things that they had to do to work in the garden, they also had to safeguard the holies. They had to protect it to make sure that there was no pollutants, nothing that was ceremonially unclean would come in and contaminate the tabernacle. They had to guard it. That was one of the things that Adam was told to do, to safeguard it. But his enemy came in and did what? He sowed tares in the midst of the wheat. He sowed his word, his seed, his philosophy. And where? Right in the midst of what God was doing. He wasn't content to have his own field of tares and leave it at that. Because he's never going to be content with that. He's always going to try to sow in the midst of what God's doing that other seed. And here's where the woman comes in. This is his gateway. He got her to be seduced. He deceived her and he used her to get to him. So I'm going to suggest something to you. That the beast in Revelation 17 has seduced her and is using her to get to somebody. I will. Let me put it to you this way. Would it be fair to say that there are congregations all over this nation, even the world, that are lowering the standards of holiness to accommodate people and want to make them feel accepted and want to make them feel loved and want to make them feel that we're tolerant and we're willing to accommodate you because that's what Jesus would do. Now, true. We should welcome those who come in whatever station, whatever status of life they are, whatever predicament they find themselves in. They should be able to come to him just as I am. However, when they leave, they should not be the way they come in. They should be transformed. We're not supposed to stay just the way I am. We're not supposed to be content to be the way I am. What we're supposed to be doing is being conformed to the image of the Son of God. Thus, the squeezing. So what I'm trying to portray to you today is what the adversary, I believe, has been doing from the very beginning. He really doesn't change his tactics up too much. He comes to steal, kill, and destroy. Ultimately, his objective is to destroy God's people. How does he do it? If he can get them to go to sleep, to relax their standards, to kind of wander off because the spirit's willing, but the flesh is weak. If he can get them to lower their standards, then he can come in and sow his words, his philosophies. And it's always going to have the appearance of being tolerant and just and accepting and fair. but it has a deadly poison contained within it. Now, there's another principle in the scripture, and that goes hand in glove with this. God's people are called to perform His purposes, serve His purposes, and when they have their focus upon Him, when they're walking upright before Him, keeping His covenant, keeping His commandments, then they're blessed, they're rewarded, they're protected, they're preserved. All the benefits, all of the blessings that go with being obedient are there. The one way that leads to life is the one way that leads to blessing. Also, the one way that leads to death is the same one that's inherently cursed. It can't be any other way. So when His people are walking upright and they live in blessing, and they are an example to others, that set apart nation is that city set upon a hill which cannot be hidden. That light that you are to be is not to be hidden under a bed or a bushel, but it was to be put on a lampstand so that everybody can see the light, can benefit from the light, and particularly, especially those who are dwelling in darkness. Again, we're not supposed to be going around and talking about all the things that we have in common with the world and what we have in common with other the religions. I'm sorry, I'm not going to refer to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as Allah in deference to Muslims. I'm not going to do it. Because what we're trying to do is, let's just see where we have common ground. That's overlapping ground. That's hot and cold mixed together, which is what? Lukewarm. And is the exact thing He says, I will spew from my mouth. So we're not to be focusing on the things that we have in common with the world, with other religions of the world, other faiths in the world. And I know that's not politically correct, tolerant, and coexistent. Get over it. What we need to be focused on what makes us different, what sets us apart. The Messiah did go to that tree. He was hung upon that tree. He was crucified. He was placed in a tomb. And He did rise again on the third day. He is the Messiah and the Son of the living God. And He's the one who said, Bill didn't say it. He's the one who said, no one comes unto the Father except by me. That doesn't sit well with some people. It offends them. I don't feel comfortable with that. Hey, my flesh doesn't either. That's the whole idea. For my flesh to get uncomfortable. So that I arise to the realization that I need to die to my flesh. Because my flesh will lead me to hell. So now. Sorry, I got a little preachy. The woman works in collaboration with the beast until the beast is through with her, and then he gets rid of her. All right. In the beginning, the woman had some kind of an association. She was seduced, deceived, and then played a role in the man's downfall. That's what he's trying to do again today. He's trying to speak to those of the church that are willing to look at that other tree and to say, you know, this tree is good for food too. This tree is pleasant to the eye. This tree is desirable to make one wise. And besides that, it makes us relevant in the world today. It makes us seeker friendly today. It opens up the doors to all of these people to come just as they are and stay the way they are, because that's what Jesus would do. Do you know what He would do if somebody came in and polluted the Father's house? Oh, He'd make a whip and He'd chase them out with it. If they were that bold and that brazen to do what was done at the door of the tent of meeting in the wilderness, He'd have made a whip. And the only reason that He would make a whip is because they had not invented rebar yet. That's what Jesus would do. And you know why? Because He loves us that much. I chasten those that I love. All right. Get back on topic, Bill. Here's where I'm going with all of this. What happens to God's people when they do not fulfill God's purposes for them and particularly as it relates to the nations of the world. He allows those that they were supposed to be a light to come in and lord over them. If you won't be a light to the darkness, I'll allow the darkness to come in and be my rod of correction for you. Here's another way to put it. You're the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its savor, its saltiness, what good is it? It's good for nothing except to be tossed into the street and to be trampled underfoot. Now, that says a lot just on one level, but we're going to take it to another level. And before we do that, I should remind you that we, as his people, have been given the authority to trample on serpents and scorpions. Now, I grew up in the South, and there were people in the South who thought that meant that we're supposed to go out into the woods, find some rattlesnakes, put them in a box, and bring them in front of the church. No. No, that's not what he meant. And then they would get bit by the snake, and you're like, well, it was a snake. I started to say something, but there are people out there watching in internet land. I better not. So it's about something you can't fix. You fill in the blank. All right. Anyway. No, that's not what he meant. What was he saying? He was alluding to the prophecy in Genesis chapter 3 when the Creator said to the serpent, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. He will bruise your head. He's going to stomp on your head and in the process have his heel bruised. That's exactly what happened. The Messiah destroyed the works of the devil when he was crucified, when he rose again. In the process, he had his heel literally bruised when they drove those spikes through his feet. But he destroyed the works of the devil. However, as you all know, the adversary is not yet contained in the pit. He's still out there at work, right? And so the Messiah says what? I'm going to give you the authority to trample on his head. I'm going to give you the authority to trample on his head. Now, you might get your heel bruised in the process, because there is no glory except there is first suffering. Ought not the Messiah to have suffered these things and then entered into his glory? Did not Joseph suffer before he entered into his glory? Before a child is born, there is this concept. And so Messiah said, if you're going to be my disciples, you take up your cross and follow me, right? And so we take up our cross, which is emblematic of saying no to ourselves, saying no to our will, our desires. How far are we going to follow him? Well, the one who endures to the end, that's the one who's going to be saved. And so look at it this way. I'm following in his footprints. I'm going to change it just a little bit. I'm following in the impressions he's made with his heel. And as I am following in the impressions that he has made with his heel, I have the authority to step on the head of the serpent. I might get my heel bruised in the process, but that's just part and parcel of following in the footsteps of the Messiah, because I have to say no to me. And how often? Every day I have to crucify my flesh. I have to say no to my will. The reason I was born again was so to learn how to die. To die to my desire, to die to my will. So I am walking in the impressions that he has left with his heel. Now, the adversary, when he was told, I'm going to put enmity between you and the woman and between your respective seeds, you'll bruise his heel, but he's going to bruise your head. He didn't slither away and give up. From that time, he's been trying, at least this is what I believe, he's been trying to reverse that decision. He's been trying to take his heel and crush the head of the righteous seed. In the beginning, Cain and Abel. Cain brings an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. His offering, his mincha, which is a meal offering, is not respected. Abel also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of their fat, and God had respect unto his mincha, his meal offering. The distinction was this. Not only did Abel bring the meal offering, just like Cain did, representing that the fruit of the ground, the things that we do with our hands, our works, if you will. But Abel also understood the importance of the blood of the lamb. So in the beginning, what was the distinction? The same thing that needs to be distinguished today. The blood of the lamb. And God had respect unto Abel and to his mincha. How did that go over with Cain? He got jealous. God speaks to him. Hey, you know what's right to do. Why don't you do the right thing? If you do the right thing, well, and I'll have respect to your offering too. But what did Cain do? Jealousy drove him to lure his brother out into the field and traditionally bludgeon him to death. That is to strike him on the head. Because you see, the serpent has been trying to take his heel and trample the salt under heel. When Rebekah was pregnant, she went to inquire of the Lord because she felt there was something wrong going on inside of her womb. And she learned that you have two nations growing inside you. They're going to be contending with one another. They're not going to get along. They're not going to coexist. But in the end, the older one is going to serve the younger one. Of course, then when she did deliver, the first one came out all red and ruddy, hairy, looked like a goat. Was so hairy, looked like he was wearing a goat coat. That would have freaked me out. A hairy baby. All over. I mean, that's E.T. stuff there. That's that program that, you know, they talk about the truth is out there. What's the name of that program? The X-Files. Yeah, that's X-Files stuff. All right, well, there was a reason. We won't get into that today, but when his brother was born, it said his brother was born with his hand on Esau's heel, Ekev. And if you take the letter Yud, the smallest Hebrew letter there is, which is phonetically equivalent to Yad, the Hebrew word for hand, you take that letter Yud and you put it on the word for a heel, the end result is Yaakov, Jacob. So that's why his name Yaakov, or Jacob, because his hand was on his brother's heel. Why was his hand on his brother's heel, though? Here's what Bill has thought for years now. It's because Esau's heel was poised to come down on the top of Jacob's head. And if his heel had come down on top of that little soft spot on Jacob's head, what might have become of Jacob? And what does the adversary come to do? To steal, to kill, to destroy. And so you see, the adversary has been trying to take his heel and trample on the head of the righteous seed. We could go on and on and on and on, but here's the point. There is a rabbinic concept referring to Genesis 3:15 to the birth of Jacob and Esau as the war of the heel. That this was a prophetic occurrence that was going to speak into the future that there was going to be this war between the righteous seed and Esau, or Edom, and those who think, act like Esau, which is essentially this. I want the stuff, but I don't want the responsibility. I want the blessing, but I don't want the suffering. That's his basic philosophy. It's mixed. It's mingled. Oh, and there is this, and I'm going to kill Jacob. I'm going to kill him. All right, so this war of the heel has been ongoing. It will culminate, of course, with the coming of the Messiah. But in the meantime, you and I are supposed to be following in the impressions left by his heel. But what if we decide, I want to go see what that is over there. I want to go check out that tree over there, or that philosophy, or that message that causes me to deviate from the path that he has already set before me. Because the steps of a good man are ordered of God. They're already established. It's the same as what happens when the salt loses its savor. It's good for nothing except to be tossed into the street and be trampled under heel. Whose heel? Those who have vowed to kill us. So it's with that that we go to Daniel. See, I had to run around Mount Sinai about 3 or 4 times to get to my point here. But in Daniel chapter 2, I won't read it all for the sake of time, but Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, who, lest I forget to share this with you later, is the first Gentile king, at least that I can recall, who God delivers Judah into his hand, according to what it says in chapter 1. He delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, and he allowed this man to destroy Jerusalem, to raise the temple to the ground, to carry off many of the temple treasures into Babylon and put him in the house of his heathen god. And he also took captives of Judea. He took them into Babylonian captivity. Among them were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, better known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Men that, as far as we know, really had not done anything wrong. They just happened to be living in Judea at this time. But my point is, he's not a Jew from the tribe of Dan that comes and destroys Jerusalem and the temple. He's a Babylonian king. He is the king of everything God despises. You see, when Babylon was established back in Genesis chapter 11, you had a group of people they said, let's come together. Let's all get together. And it said they were of one mind and they were of one speech. And even though in English that sounds like, you know, it might be the same thing. What it was saying is they spoke the same language, yes, but because they had the same mindset. And that mindset, let's come together and let's make some bricks. Because apparently there weren't any stones out there in the middle of the desert. So they had to make some bricks. Now, we need to understand that bricks are emblematic of man trying to replicate what only God can do. By that I mean, God is the one who forms stones and rocks. He creates them. How does he create them? How does he shape them? How does he form them? Heat, pressure. You know what the word is? Zara. And so through heat and pressure, God forms stones. He forms rocks. And then he takes these living stones, according to Peter, and he puts them together, establishing a spiritual house, Peter says. And so we are called living stones, aren't we? Not living bricks. Because bricks are man's attempt to replicate this. And how do you make bricks, at least the way they did it then? Well, you take clay, you take straw and water, and then you mix it all together. So that when you've done a good job, the clay and the straw and the water have all lost their distinctive properties. They've just all kind of fused one to the other, so you can't tell the difference. Everybody's the same. Everybody's equal. Then you take this mixture and you pour it into a mold that a man made so that the bricks will all be conformed to the image of man. What man says it should be. And when the sun comes out, or if they used a fire to dry out the bricks, that's man's attempt of replicating the pressure that God uses. And so when all this is done and the bricks are dried, the first brick looks like the second brick, which looks like the tenth brick, which looks like the last brick. They're all uniform. They all look the same. Then compare that to stones and rocks. God didn't make rocks equal. God didn't make rocks to look exactly the same, did he? And some rocks are common, you know, granite, marble, shale, sandstone, things like that. Then some rocks, some stones are considered to be precious. You know, emeralds, rubies, sapphires. You know, the kind of stones that make up the breastplate. that the priest would wear on his heart. And those stones, by the way, represent the 12 tribes of Israel, right? Represents the family, the set-apart nation. And how are sapphires and rubies and emeralds and these kinds of precious stones, how are they formed? Pressure, just more of it. I'll let that percolate for just a second. They're formed by pressure as well. It's just more intense. It's hotter. Think about that the next time you're going through hell and you look down the street at your heathen neighbor and everything seems to be going pretty good for him right now. And why am I going through this? Well, I just have to believe that he is shaping and molding those that he calls his precious stones, his jewels. We have to go through that pressure. Exodus 19, you saw what I did unto the Egyptians and how I bore you unto myself upon eagle's wings. Now, if you will indeed hear my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all peoples, for all the earth is mine. You'll be a kingdom, a priest, and a holy nation. Peculiar treasure, segula, literally means jewels. You'll be my precious stones above all the people of the earth. You're not just going to be granite and marble and shale and sandstone. You're going to be emeralds, rubies, sapphires, those things that make up my jewels, those things that, those stones that I wear on my heart. That's what you're going to be. Now, let me just throw this little tidbit in there too. It's not about how shiny it is. It's not about how it looks. It's about what it does. Let me put it to you this way. A piece of marble that serves God's purpose is more valuable to him than a diamond that does not serve his purpose. So what happens to the salt that is not serving its purpose? It gets thrown out into the street and it's trampled under heel. So that's what they made Babylon of, brick. What is Jerusalem comprised of? Stone. And so you have this dichotomy, these distinctions. What does Babylon want to do? He wants to mix everything together. He wants everything and everyone to be equal. No borders, no boundaries, no distinctions, no gender. Wants to erase all the boundaries that God has established. Why? Because that's the act of a rebel. Nimrod was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Literally, he was a mighty hunter in the face of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. He opposed him. He rebelled against him. And then he used words to seduce people in joining him in this rebellion. Perhaps they did it unwittingly. Perhaps he appealed to things they wanted. He told them what they wanted to hear. He appealed to hidden desires. That's probably what the adversary did in Genesis 3. There was probably this secret desire within the woman that he awakened with the words, "Has God not said that you may freely eat of all the trees of the garden?" That's what Nimrod does. And he gets the people to join him in this rebellion. We're going to have brick. We're going to fire brick. We're going to make this city. We're going to make a tower that reaches up into heaven. And we're all going to come together lest we be scattered abroad across the face of the earth. God has said to Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, spread out, multiply, fill the earth. What does Nimrod say? No. Let's come together. Let's collect ourselves together. Let's just be one big happy family. We don't want to be different nations across the world. We want to be one nation. We want to be a global society that doesn't recognize borders that God has instituted. In fact, we want to make a name for ourselves, it says. This is all in Genesis chapter 11. And the word name is in Hebrew Shem, which literally means reputation or authority. Here's what they were saying. We're going to establish our authority. We're going to establish our reputation in the earth by determining what is lawful and what is not. Our authority will supersede that of the creators. I got news for you. We're there. There are people who have lost their minds, as my dad would say. He'd say to me, "Boy, much learning has made you mad." That was when I was a teenager and I knew everything. The whole world is collectively, and I'm saying this metaphorically, a bunch of teenagers. It's no wonder they're putting teenagers out here on the television to tell us what we should do and shouldn't do, because that's the way the rulers of the world are acting, like a bunch of spiritual teenagers. No offense to the teenagers in the room. But you will one day learn that your father and mother were pretty smart people. You don't know that yet, but you will come to understand that the old man is not as dumb as I had him figured for. But the rulers of this world, the rulers of this nation, many of them do not see it that way because they're acting like a bunch of teenagers. Like, we know more than our Father in heaven. We know what's right and we're going to establish our authority. That is Babylonian thinking. And that's why I say it is the epitome of everything God detests and hates. And yet God allows the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, to come in and to destroy Jerusalem. He allows the bricks to break down the rocks, the stones. So now in chapter 2, this king, Nebuchadnezzar, has a dream. And it troubled him. And as we continue to read in Daniel 2, again, I won't read it for the sake of time, we see that either he didn't remember the dream completely, or he remembers it, but he wants to make sure that these soothsayers and magicians and astrologers are going to be able to give him the actual interpretation and not just say something vague. So here's the way he does it. All right, I've had a dream, guys, and I've decided that you need to be able to tell me the dream and what it means, or I'm going to kill you. That's power. And that's exactly what he said. Now, it just so happens that Daniel is one of those men. Because Daniel was a man who sat at the gates. Why was he allowed to be put in this position, in this predicament, if you will? It's because he decided weeks, months, maybe years before, that when he was in Nebuchadnezzar's academy, along with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that they were not going to defile themselves. They purposed in their heart, they were not going to mix and to mingle and eat the king's delicacies and drink his wine. And they came out of that situation fairer than everybody else, healthier than everybody else. And because of that, they were recognized. They were set apart. They were distinguished from everybody else. And so he put them in very important positions. Daniel sitting in the gates, making judgments. And so you could say that the reason Daniel's in this predicament of, I need to figure out what the dream is and tell the interpretation or I'm going to die, was because God put him in that predicament. You might could say that God was putting the squeeze on him. Same goes for Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The reason they found themselves on the plain of Dura in chapter 2 is because God had put them there. And why did God put them there? Why do you think he orchestrated this situation, this scenario? Here's what I think. Because he needed some people who would stand when everyone else was bowing. He needed those who would, when they've done all they could do to stand, they stand. That did not conform to the thinking of this world, but had been transformed. Their minds renewed. They were standing fast by the one that they served. He still is master. He still is sovereign. His word still is law. His authority is final. And it is my duty, it is my job, the reason I am here, regardless of what may happen to me. O king, we know that you are a king of kings, they said. But we serve the king of kings. And even if you kill us, we still will not bow down. I would submit to you that those are people who overcame by the blood of the Lamb, the word of their testimony, and they love not their lives even unto death. And you know what came about as a result of those men taking that stand? The most powerful man in the world has to confess when he said, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, you servants of the Most High God. He had to acknowledge that he was the Most High God. See, Nebuchadnezzar was kind of proud of himself. later on in Daniel's book, he's going around looking at everything he's built. Is this not great Babylon that I have built? Look what I have done. You know, it's like Tom Hanks with the fire on the beach in Castaway. Look what I have done. I have made fire. Obviously, you're Pentecostal and don't go to the movies. All right, that's right. All right. All right. I have made this great Babylon. And when he's saying that, you remember what happened to him? He turned into a beast. And how long was he a beast? 7 years. Not a Jew from the tribe of Dan. The Gentile king. All right? All right. So he says, all right, you need to tell me what this dream is. Tell me what it means or I'm going to kill you. So Daniel goes and prays all that night. Are you talking about a prayer meeting? You talking about being motivated to touch God and to hear back? So, and this is so fascinating to me, and it is such an encouragement to me. You think of this dream and the dream in Genesis chapter 41, the one that Joseph is called upon to interpret for Pharaoh. Pharaoh had the dream. He just didn't know what it meant. Nebuchadnezzar has the dream. He just doesn't know what it means. Some of the most powerful dreams prophetically, those things that are related to the end of days, they weren't given to God's people. They were given to pagan, godless kings, the most powerful men then on earth. It's just that God didn't give them the interpretation. And so he needed somebody who was in the right place at the right time, who had probably been thinking all that time, we're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Joseph was in prison being squeezed. Daniel was in captivity. And yet from God's point of view, they were exactly where they needed to be. You know, I said earlier, the adversary comes and sows tares in the midst of the wheat. You know what's interesting? Sometimes God sows wheat in the midst of the tares. Maybe that's what El Shaddai is. Did I say that out loud? I'm sorry. Man, when I was leaving the airport, you know, I'd heard about it, but I'm riding down the road and I'm seeing billboards. Bill's translation, come here, smoke dope. I heard that you, Bill, if you're going to get some coffee, go into a well-established coffee place. Don't go to any coffee stand on the road. I've been warned not to do that. Y'all are crazy. Or this area, I'm sure. So maybe that's what El Shaddai is. Maybe sometimes we find ourselves in situations we wonder what we're doing here. But sometimes God sows the wheat in the midst of the tares. Why? Because there comes a point in time when Nebuchadnezzar is going to have a dream. Pharaoh is going to have a dream, but he doesn't know what it means. And there needs to be that man, that woman of God, who's been in the right place at the right time, who've gone through the suffering, who've gone through the squeezing, and have purged those unfruitful things for their lives, and who are exactly where the Creator wants them to be. And in an instant, and very suddenly, they're called upon to stand upon before kings and rulers and leaders to give them an answer of peace, whereby that king or ruler has to confess that your God is God. But then there is the other side of it. When you read in Daniel 1, you see that Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego were not the only men of Judah who went into Nebuchadnezzar's academy. They were just among those who went into Nebuchadnezzar's school to learn the ways and the language of the Chaldeans. But you never hear about those men ever again. Why? Apparently they buckled. Apparently they ate the king's delicacies and drank the king's wine. I just kind of wonder what that cup looked like. It was full of all that wine. And did they allow themselves to be intoxicated with it? Because when you're intoxicated, you don't think straight. I'm not going to get into too much detail, but there was a time when I was a teenager and I knew everything. I thought that there were certain amounts of certain things that I could consume and it was not going to do anything to me. In fact, I thought I was Superman. I thought I could do anything. I thought I could do anything that I could imagine. And that's exactly what happens when the world becomes intoxicated with the wine of her fornication. They think they are Superman. They think they can do whatever they want to do. However, there comes a time and a place when you're going to have to sober up. And it's a painful, painful experience. Unfortunately, there are many of God's people that went into Nebuchadnezzar's academy and drank his wine. And eventually, they're going to find themselves on the plain of Dura with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So Daniel is laying on his bed, and God gives him the dream. And then he gives him the interpretation of the dream. Verse 19 of Daniel 2. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. And so Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever. For wisdom and might are his. He changes the times and seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. And I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might and have now made known to me what we ask of you. For you have made known to us the king's demand." And so then Daniel goes to the king's servant and say, "I've got it. Get me an audience before the king." And he goes and he appears before Nebuchadnezzar and he describes to him what he dreamt. I'm sure you've read it, studied it. He saw this image of a man, 60 cubits high, which would be approximately 90 feet tall. 60 cubits high, 6 cubits wide, and it was this fearsome image. It was awe-inspiring. And it had a head of gold and chest and arms of silver and belly and thighs of brass and 2 iron legs and 2 feet, 10 toes, ironed, mingled, the Hebrew term there, merav, mixed with clay. So it says that you saw this. And then in verse 34 of Daniel 2, after you see the head of gold, the chest and arms of silver, on down to the 2 feet, the iron mingled with clay, it says in verse 34, "You watched while a stone was cut without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay." By the way, that word there means baked clay, which kind of reminds me of making bricks. It says that you saw, watch while a stone was cut without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the earth. Now, from there, after describing what he saw, he goes to interpret what these things mean. He says, in verse 37, "You, king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold." And so he had just said to the creator, when he thanked him and blessed him, "You're the one that raises up kings. You're the one that brings down empires. You're the one who allows these people to have power." It's like when the Messiah was standing before Pontius Pilate and he says, "Don't you know that I have the power to take your life?" And he says, "The only power you have is what God has given you." God is the one who puts these people in these positions, whether we like them or not. Because the reason most of the time when we don't like them is because we are under their heel. Let's put it this way. If this war or battle of the heel, Esau and Jacob and what it represents, the righteous seed and the other seed, who seems to be telling who what to do these days? Who seems to be determining how culture is going to function and what's going to be right and what's going to be considered to be wrong? Who seems to be calling the shots these days? Doesn't seem to be us. Doesn't seem to be me. So the reason we're usually in a situation where we don't like the leaders is because we're under their heel. Well, what does that tell me? I haven't been being the salt. We haven't been the light that we've been called to be. And you know why we're not the salt and the light the way that he wants us to be? Usually because the world has something in us. There's some kind of a hold. There's some kind of a grip. And so that's why the pressure has to come. That's why the squeezing has to come. That's why we have to feel the pressure of being under the world's heel. So he says, you are the head of gold. Babylon is the head. Now, there's the body of Messiah. Who's the head? Messiah is. That was not a trick question. Some of you are like, The body of Messiah. Okay, anyway, that was the first clue. All right, so he's the head. Now, do the legs tell the head what to do? They do not. The head tells the legs where to go. The head tells the arms what to do. So everything that is about direction, everything that is supposed to be accomplished in the body of Messiah comes from the head. Now, here's a body in Daniel chapter 2. And it has a head too. And who's the head? Babylon. What was written on the woman's forehead? Mystery. Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. So who's the head of this body? Everything that it is emanates from Babylon, which means everything that it is opposing the body of Messiah. It's about coming against the body of Messiah, coming against God's purposes in the earth. And it starts with Babylon, and then he goes on and describes how the kingdoms that come after you are going to be weaker. They're not going to be as strong as you in some ways. And history and eschatology teaches us that after the Babylonians came the Medes and Persians, and that's the chest and arms of silver. And then after that came Alexander and the Grecians, and that's the belly and thighs of brass. And now there are some Jewish commentators that include the Roman Empire with the belly and thighs of brass because it claims that they're basically related. And there was a Middle Ages Jewish commentator by the name of Ibn Ezra that says the two iron legs were actually an Arab empire. Interesting. And that when we get down into the feet and toes, iron mingled with clay, Ibn Ezra says that it's, and this is not what he wrote, but this would be the conclusion, that it's not a revived Roman Empire that we're looking for. It's a revived Arab empire that we're looking for. It's a revived Islamic empire that we're looking for. That's a sidebar. We'll have to do that next time I come to town. All right? Interesting to consider. All right? Because if the two legs are iron and he goes on down in the feet, then you would think, yeah, revived Roman Empire. Except, where is Rome in the beginning? It's not there. And even if the iron legs are the Roman Empire, do the legs tell the head what to do? No. The adversary is an illusionist. And what does an illusionist do? He wants you looking at all the flashy, colorful stuff over in this hand. Why? Because he doesn't want you to look at what he's doing with this hand. He wants you, I'm going to say it this way, he wants you looking at Rome. So you're looking for this guy to arise out of a revived Roman Empire. Some people say he's a Jew from the tribe of Dan, which, by the way, technically is an impossibility. Jews are from Judah. Danites are from Dan. And he's going to come up and he's going to be this great man of peace, and the whole world is going to go after him. Everybody's going to love him. He's going to make a peace treaty with Israel for 7 years. In the midst of that, he's going to get shot in the head. He's going to come back to life. All hell's going to break loose. Most of that's not even in the Bible. That's just things that have been handed down to us. Now, I don't want anybody to get left behind on this. Doom, doom, right? But most of that's not even the Bible. The whole getting shot in the head is based on Revelation 13. The beast that has seven heads arises out of the seas, out of the nations, and one of those seven heads received a deadly wound with the edge of the sword, and the deadly wound was healed. And then you read after that, and the focus is on Babylon, 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 Babylon. So I have said, kind of tongue-in-cheek through the years, that I will concede that if there is a man who arises out of Rome and he has seven heads, he's the dude. But if that doesn't happen, it seems to me that the head is Babylon. Babylon is more than a place. It's more than an archaeological site. It is a way of thinking. It transcends borders. It affects all nations. And Babylonian thinking is mixed and mingled thinking. It's erasing borders, erasing distinctions, erasing boundaries, taking things that are unique and mixing them together until they're conformed to our image, not the image that God has established. That's what Babylon is. And might it be that all this time the adversary has been waving Rome around for us to be distracted by, and all the while Babylon is growing right under our noses? Because you see, Babylon is in Tacoma. Yeah. Babylon is in Washington. Oh yeah, New York too. And yeah, Rome, it's there, but it's in London and it's in Melbourne. It's in Jerusalem. It is a way of thinking that the whole world has been intoxicated with, to erase all these boundaries. And what is it doing? The leaders and the rulers of this world are force-feeding it to the populations of the world, getting them to devour this, to ingest this, to act upon this, and then seeking out those that are resisting it, alienating those who are resisting it, sequestering those. Did you hear about the proposed bill in the California legislature which would seek to outlaw any text that speaks against the LGBT agenda? Of course, my first reaction was, oh, they mean the Bible. Because I think I can find some places that this contradicts the LGBT agenda. So you see what's happening here? People are being fed this philosophy, and in the way that this is good. This is inclusive. Now, don't get me wrong. We want to be that light that those who live in darkness are drawn to, who come from these backgrounds, who come from these different lifestyles, who are in the clutches of things that kill and destroy. And we want to be those that the Messiah working in us and through us, we can impact those lives in a positive way. We don't hate those people. Everybody understands that, right? But we cannot condone, we cannot endorse, we cannot erase the boundaries just to make people feel comfortable. I have never read this book, read what God says, walked away from it thinking, you know, Bill, you're a pretty good guy. Not once. Every time I read this book, I am overcome with this feeling of, God, help me. I am in need of a redeemer. Thank you for your mercy. Thank you for your goodness. Thank you for your compassion. And then when I read about how he finally says at times, that's enough. I have this fear. It's a godly fear, but it is a fear. We could use a good dose of that. And I'm talking about the body. Because when the salt is no longer salty, and the light is no longer being a beacon, the salt gets tossed out into the street and gets trampled under the heel of those very people that we were supposed to be a light to. They end up being used as a rod of correction. Now, verse 41 of Daniel 2 says, whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, The kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. And as you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. So he's describing this very last kingdom. So we've come down from Babylon, the Medes and the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, maybe, you know, an Islamic empire, a caliphate of the past. But eventually we make our way down to the feet and toes, because that's the kingdom that exists when the stone cut from a mountain without hands comes and strikes the image on the feet. So that's going to be the kingdom of man at the end of days. By the way, how many of you believe that we're living in the end of days? Anybody? All right, so the last kingdom before the Messiah's kingdom comes to this world is described to us in Daniel 2 as being feet with 10 toes, iron mixed with clay. It's a divided kingdom. It's because it's a mixed kingdom. It's two things that were never intended to be mixed together, trying to be mixed together. So what was that tree that was in the beginning that the adversary was using to seduce the woman with in order to get at the man? It was a mixed and mingled tree. It was good and evil. And what did it render? Death. This is essentially the same thing. It's going to appeal to those who can be lured away by those things that are attractive to the eye. It's also a kingdom. Well, we know that the 10 toes represent 10 kings. Again, we won't get all into that. But do you know what else is on a foot besides toes? A heel. You see, I'm convinced that what this is also representing is this is the last kingdom of man that is going to try to put God's people under their heel. And if you read very carefully in the book of Revelation and in Daniel, you will see that God is going to allow the beast, he is going to allow the rulers of this world to make war with the saints and for a time prevail. God's going to allow it. Because in the end, it serves God's purposes. You and I are in this battle of the heel. We're trying to keep the heel off the top of our head. Why are we in that position? Because we fell asleep. Because we let our guard down. All of us, myself included, we let our guard down. The things of this world that had a hold of us, things that aren't necessarily inherently evil, those things aren't obviously wicked, but it's anything that would seduce us into getting our eyes off the ball, to getting our eyes off what we are here for, to get our eyes on anything and everything except the focus, and that is the Messiah ultimately and his purposes. We all fell asleep. Not just this generation. It goes back for some time. It's been kind of progressively getting worse. It's the proverbial toad in the boiling pot. But now, here is, I think, what distinguishes you and me, this generation, from previous generations. The time is obviously getting short. And our eyes are being awakened to things. I don't know if you remember, but in Revelation 17, we read how there was this mystery about the woman, and there was a mystery about the beast. And when this beast comes back to life, the people of this world whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world are going to be marveling and amazed. Which tells me that the people whose names are written in the book of life from the foundation of the world aren't going to be taken by surprise. They're not going to marvel. They saw this coming. You know why? Because surely the Lord God does nothing except he revealed his secret unto his servants, the prophets. You know what? God wants his people to know what's about to happen. Why? Because it is a call to his people to get ready for what is about to happen. And how does he get our attention? Usually, not with the shofar. You know how he usually gets our attention? When stuff starts going wrong. When stuff starts getting squeezed in our lives. I'm tempted to take a poll, but I won't. But I know in my heart and spirit that I'm not the only one who's getting squeezed. So that kingdom, that last kingdom, is one that comes to try to trample on God's people. In fact, you can read it in Daniel chapter 4 or in Daniel 7. That fourth beast, it tramples and breaks in pieces under heel, underfoot, because that's what the adversary is trying to do now. So we're like Jacob, trying to keep that heel from crushing our head. You know what made the difference for Jacob? He had an encounter. When the call came for, all right, you've been living in Syria long enough. You've been living out there among the nations long enough. Interesting. It's among the nations that Jacob, Israel, if you will, multiplies and grows. Not in the land. Later on, they will go down to Egypt. They'll go from 70 to being 2 to 3 million people. He grows his people. He multiplies his people among the nations. But then there always comes a time for him to say, okay, now it's time to come back to the land. But before you come back into the land, Jacob had to have an encounter. He hears tell that his brother Esau is coming with 400, presumably armed men, and he is afraid. Why? Because Esau's threatened to kill him. He's the guy that was born having to protect his head from Esau's heel. And now he hears that Esau's coming. He's got 400 men with him. And he sent everybody away. And the Bible tells us that there's a point he finds himself all alone. And then how, when, we're not exactly sure. But he encounters a man who has the face of God. And when he encounters this man, a wrestling match broke out. It doesn't tell us why they were wrestling. It just says they're wrestling and the day is breaking. They've been wrestling all night. And the man says, you need to let me go, for day is breaking. He says, I'm not letting go of you until you bless me. And then he asks him a very odd question in response. What's your name? My name is Hand on a Heel. I'm the guy that feels like at any moment I'm going to be crushed and destroyed. And I feel like I'm going down. My adversary's heel is about to come down on my head. That's who I am. And he said, well, I'll tell you what. From this day forward, your name is not going to be called Hand on a Heel. But your name is Israel. Because you have striven with God and will prevail over men. Because of your encounter with God, wrestling with God. Now, I won't pretend to know exactly what that was about, Jacob and the man who has the face of God. But I can tell you in my life what how it translates. There comes a point in time, and this is happening, has happened in my life. I feel I'm in a place that the very life is being squeezed out of me. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what to do. I know what I feel like you've called me to do, but I just can't see it happening because Esau's coming. He's got 400 men with him. I feel like I'm going down. And so I'm wrestling with God. I know you do it for Abraham. I know you did it for Isaac. I know you did it for Jacob. I know you did it for Joseph. I know you did it for Moses. I know you did it for all of those guys. My question is, will you do that for me? And it's not an issue of can you. I know you can. The issue is, will you? Because you know me. You know what kind of a person I have the potential to be. You know what I think sometimes. You know what I want to say, what I want to do sometimes. And don't look at me all pious. You know me. And there comes a point in our walk that we have to just wrestle with that. And to Jacob, he says, you're Israel. You have striven with God, and you will prevail over your enemies. Which is to say that no longer will you be the one whose head is beneath their heel, but you're going to take your heel and put it on their head. And you know why he said that? And why he says that to you and to me? Because the one who destroyed the works of the devil and crushed his head told us we have the authority to trample on serpents as long as we are walking in the impressions left by his heel. I'll put it this way, as long as we are walking as Israel. Because from that point forward, Jacob, now known as Israel, which to me translates into him being born again, has a distinctive walk that distinguishes him from everybody else. He's going to walk with a limp for the rest of his life so that when people see him coming down the road, they can identify him as being Israel. Well, how do you know it's Israel? Well, look how he walks. I'll let that percolate for a second. We're not supposed to be going out there and seeing how we can accommodate people's lifestyles by finding common ground. We are supposed to be out there in the world walking in the way our Creator has told us to walk. Because if we do that, it identifies us as belonging to Him. And that in itself will serve to be a beacon to those who are in darkness. You are a city set upon a hill which cannot be hidden. Not supposed to be hidden. It's supposed to be a shining light, particularly to those who hate you. We're not supposed to just congregate with those who love us and like us. We're supposed to engage those who hate us, who want to destroy us, who seek to persecute us. Because those are the ones who need what we have. I'll close with this. And in the days of these kings, that is the ten kings, this last kingdom, the feet, the iron, merav, mixed with clay, the one that wants to stamp out and stomp on God's people. In the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all of these kingdoms. And it shall stand forever because the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our God and of his Messiah. Inasmuch, here's why I say that, King. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain and its interpretation is sure. In other words, including yours, Nebuchadnezzar, the kingdoms of this world will ultimately be destroyed by the stone that was cut from a mountain without hands. And when Nebuchadnezzar heard this, he fell on his face because he knew that this man had heard from God. But the point is, who's the stone? The stone that the builders rejected. Have you never read this in the scripture? The stone the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. This is the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes. And I tell you that whoever falls upon this stone will be broken. Whoever stumbles on this stone, who humbles himself and is broken. That's talking about people like you and me, hopefully. It's best to be broken by stumbling on it. Because those who will not, he says, but whoever this stone falls upon will be ground to powder. That's talking about all those kingdoms. That when that stone comes and it strikes that image on its feet, the whole thing is going to be destroyed. It's going to be ground to powder, and then the wind's going to come and blow it all away, and there's not going to be one speck of it left. Because that stone is going to grow up into a very great mountain, and it's going to fill the entire earth. And the knowledge of the Lord shall fill the earth or cover the earth as the seas cover the earth. It's going to fill up the whole world because that was his intention in the first place, to sow the good seed in the field, that the field would be filled with the sons of the kingdom, not all this other stuff. All right, my point. He said, Daniel said, it will be in the days of these kings that the stone cut from the mountain without hands will strike this image and destroy all these kingdoms. And I'm telling you, I believe with my whole heart that that kingdom is being established right now. the message of that kingdom is already going forth, and I see evidence all around me that the inhabitants of the earth are becoming drunk with the wine of the fornication. The mindset of Babylonian thinking, coexistence, tolerance, equality, inclusion, all these things that on the surface sound so noble, sound so honorable, sound so good, but what do you have to accommodate in order to attain this? It boils down to this. Nebuchadnezzar, after Daniel told him this, he goes out and he doesn't make an image of gold, silver, bronze, and iron. He made an image entirely of gold, 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide. Why? He made an image of himself, and he commanded that everybody get together, and when you hear the musicians play, let's make it sound like the symphony. You know, it's kind of like the band on the decks of the Titanic playing, you know, chamber music as the ship is singing. But he collects all these people and says, when you hear the music playing in symphonies, bow down to this image. Sound familiar? It should. But there are always those select few that they determined and purposed in their heart they would not defile themselves with the king's meat or his wine. And they see that as this is happening, that what they're supposed to do is stand. That's all they did. They stood. And guess what? That did not deliver them from the fire. That ensured they were going to go into the fire. It's just that something happened maybe they weren't expecting, is that when they got tossed into the fire, he was already there waiting on them. Father, to the best of my ability, I've shared what I feel like you placed upon my heart, and so I now pray that, as I prayed in the beginning, that your word will be heard within the words, that your message will be perceived within the message, and that what you wish to impart to us as individuals, families, as a fellowship, to those who are watching on the live stream, those things that you wish to impart to us by your Spirit, that is what would burn within our hearts. That is what would permeate our being, and it would transform us into the image of your Son. I thank you for these people. And I ask you to bless them. And if you will stand, please. I'm going to pronounce the Aaronic blessing. I don't can't, but I'm just going to pronounce it. Yivarechecha Adonai v'yishmerecha, Ya'er Adonai panav alecha v'yichonecha, Yisa Adonai panav alecha v'yisim lecha shalom, B'shem Yeshua HaMashiach, Sar Shalom. Amen v'amen. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you, be gracious unto you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you shalom, give you peace, give you wholeness, give you completeness. In the name of his Son, the Prince of Peace, Yeshua, our Messiah, our Redeemer, our King. Amen and amen. Shabbat shalom. Savior.